Hello and welcome to edition 410 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Tom Edwards.
On this week's programme, we'll be speaking to the author James Hawes, the writer who has turned his pen to subjects ranging from the movie business to Franz Kafka. We'll be explaining his newest book, The Shortest History of Germany, and we'll see if he can keep it brief.
Plus, we'll be joined by Tate Britain curator Claire Barlow. She's overseeing the museum's new show, Queer British Art, 1861 to 1967, which looks at the role of gender and sexuality in some of the UK's most revered artworks.
And we'll be talking architecture and how to capture it on film with the filmmaker Kaspar Astrup Schroeder. His documentary, Big Time, trains its focus on the life of influential Danish architect Bjarke Ingels.
All that, plus Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli will be in charge of the towering eyesore that is the news. Look ahead, and we'll play some new music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Edition 410, we are back in the chairs, Andrew. After I'm slightly surprised because we had some production difficulties on last week's programme, which the listeners will be unaware of. It was a question of Andrew Tuck trying to retain his focus.
Oh, yes.
There's some in-studio hijinks.
And there is an outtake from that, which...
We'll never see the light of day.
Well, I hope not, because you got me laughing and I was banging the table and crying for some reason. It's when the joking takes off. We've had a good week, anyway.
Very good week. Yeah, update. What's our global listeners are keen to know what's happening at Midori House Towers and around the world.
Well, let's talk about dinner. There's a very nice restaurant here. It's called Carousel, where they have a revolving kind of list of chefs. And they had a gentleman over from Oregon. And one of our team very wisely said, let's go. We ate a lot of food that night.
It was a treat. That was a treat for the senses. I think we work out the kilo weight gain from the collective group. It's the size of a small family hatchback.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of kind of sighing in the next morning.
Very good. Yeah, I was a little delicate on whatever day of the week that was. It all blended into one after that. No, excellent stuff.
And then here at Midori, teams off around the world. So Rob Bound is currently in Tel Aviv. He's doing a report for the quality of life issue. Josh, he headed off to Zurich. He's been working there. Nolan is back out in Singapore for a week. So our team all around the world. You and me had the good slap-up dinner.
Globetrotters, one and all. But we have managed to still, nevertheless, handpick some of the finest minds and voices you could wish to find anywhere in the globe. And they're all going to be here this Sunday lunchtime. Sadly, though, we have to set the bar lower to start. We're going to kick things off with Danny Giacopelli.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day. 'Cause Danny...
Looking ahead to next week's news today, it's the mercifully one and only Daniel Giacopelli.
How are you, Tom? How are you, Andrew?
I'm very good. That's a nice mother of pearl button you got on today.
I got this shirt at a Monocle trunk sale. What do you call it?
You can call it a trunk sale. It's good.
Thanks. It's Japanese.
Okay.
So here we are. Shall we get into the news?
We probably
should. You've done your styling tip, so let's go.
All right. Coming up this following week, Donald Trump is going to meet Erdogan in Washington, D.C. The controversial president of Turkey is meeting his American counterpart, and God knows what they're going to talk about, but Trump seems to be a fan of Erdogan's. He called him to congratulate him when he won that referendum. So that's to look forward to. That's coming up on the 16th and 17th of May.
Trump seems to like these singular, you know, these sort of strong men type leaders, which I think speaks volumes. One wonders, though, who will be imparting the most important advice to the other? It's hard to know, isn't it?
They're playing by the same playbook, so...
Well, he's hoping that Duterte is going to come and visit as well, isn't he? And Kim Jong-un, so he's kind of...
Get all them in a room together.
Indeed.
How'd you go about covering that on a radio program?
The ghost
Danny?
Of Mussolini, too, maybe. Also coming up next week, big election in Iran, the presidential election. It's happening on the 19th. And the candidates are Hassan Rouhani, the current incumbent, but also the former president, Ahmadinejad, who we all know. He was rejected, so he can't run anymore. And it's a bit controversial because he threw his hat in the ring and it was thrown back to him.
It was thrown back in his face like an old sock.
Who's
going to win, Danny? I know you've been researching these subjects deeply in preparation for this moment.
It's not yet clear, actually.
In no way is that a legitimate question.
All of my polling suggests it's still up in the air, so...
Okay.
Well, the interesting thing, if it's not Rouhani who triumphs, then it's even more complicated for Trump. Obviously, Trump has already said he's going to kind of, you know, try and at some point put the pressure on the Iranians to improve the deal around the nuclear discussions. Mm. But if it's not Rouhani, if it did go to a hardline, then that would be a very unpleasant situation to find yourself in, especially when you're also dealing with North Korea.
Yeah, well, there's only six candidates that were approved, essentially. So it's Rouhani, the current VP, the mayor of Tehran, and a few other people.
I guess one of the questions with Trump, I certainly, after the last few days, you wonder whether he'll, you know, will he still be around even later in this term?
I thought you were going to say, will he throw his hat in the ring as well? There's so many hats in there.
Also, speaking of Trump, he's making his first overseas visit, just about actually on the same day as the Iranian election. He's going to Saudi Arabia for a summit with leaders from the Muslim world. Then he's going to go to Israel. Following that, he's off to the Vatican to meet with the Pope. That should be a meeting that will be very interesting. Then he's off to Brussels for the NATO summit and then the G7 summit in Sicily. This is his first time leaving America since becoming president.
Do you know what I find quite interesting about that itinerary? And it's particularly interesting if you bear in mind that he actually did welcome Abbas already to the White House, so he already met with him. Weirdly, I can't think of too many recent presidents where potentially the most controversial meeting on that particular tour could be the one with the Pope. I actually think he'll probably be fine with Bibi, the Saudis, they'll make nice. And in a way, the some of the most intriguing flashpoints or the most weird kind of clashes of character come at the Vatican City, which is kind of a strange turn up.
Pope says what's on his mind. I mean,
maybe they'll get on.
You could see Francis saying to him, look, what are you doing?
But I mean, that's probably the one I'm more intrigued by of those three stop-off points, which is a funny turn of events.
My son, you're turning into a dictator.
I wonder if he might be a bit jealous of the Vatican, though. It's even shinier than Mar-a-Lago, isn't it?
Yeah. I think they've got more actual gold there as well, yeah.
What else? Here in London, Photo London is happening, actually, coming up on the 18th. I'll be going. It'll be actually really good because, not to plug the entrepreneurs, but, you know, why not? It's the 70th anniversary of Magnum Photos. I've been doing this radio piece on their future, essentially, and one of their big-time photographers, David Hearn, he's going to be doing a big exhibition there. So you should check it out.
He's a bit of a friend of yours now, isn't he?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. But
I love Photo London. So obviously there's Paris Photo, but Photo London has grown over the last... This will be the third iteration. But it's kind of grown very nicely and it kind of spills out now of the main venue and lots of other people get inspired by it around the city.
Yeah. And it's at Somerset House, great venue. So that's happening in a few days. And finally, if you're in the Asia-Pacific region, you might want to go to Australia for the International Beer Awards. It's the preeminent showcase of beer in the Asia-Pacific region, and that's happening on the 18th. And also here in the UK, I just have to throw this in, it's the annual British Sandwich Week, celebrating the sandwich.
All week? I can get on board with
that. How many sandwiches do you think are eaten every year in the UK?
Just by me or by the whole civilization?
By the entirety of the UK.
Well, I don't know. There's 50 million people here. Half of them probably eat sandwiches.
11.5 billion sandwiches.
I was just going to say that.
No, you...
I was just doing the math.
That is a lot of sandwiches.
As you say, in New York.
That would probably take me 1 to 2 hours to eat my way through that. Big old plate of sandwiches.
There we are. But that's happening on the
14th. You'd want to have a chocolate cookie afterwards.
I need to just have something a little sweet just to finish it off, yeah.
Okay, well, Danny, thank you very much for joining us. Europe, even the most optimistic of observers might agree, is currently experiencing something of a crisis. The continent is divided about how best to fix issues ranging from political populism to immigration and financial upheaval.
But one nation at the heart of it has been a rock of relatively sane stability, Germany. Its leader Angela Merkel is someone that nearly everybody likes. Its economy goes from strength to strength. Its capital, Berlin, once the very front line of the Cold War, is now the archetypal liberal-minded city. Monocle's Quality of Life conference will be heading there this summer.
So what has the nation done right and wrong too, of course? Well, James Hoare's new book, The Shortest History of Germany, tries to figure this out. And he joins us now in the studio. And I'm very pleased to say that James is also going to be with us in Berlin explaining many of the ideas that he has in this book. Now, first of all, the need for the shortest history of Germany. If you go to a bookshop, you'll find numerous books about German history, including many about, I guess, the Third Reich. But why did you feel that there was a place for a new book? And I must say, I can tell the audience why I think, but why did you feel that there was a time for a new book now?
I think because I've been studying Germany one way or another for an awful long time. in my life. And I've always had this vague feeling that it all was not well with the story we're telling about it. And I was never quite sure what that was. So when the publisher approached me and said, would I do this? I said to him, you know, I'd love to do that, but I really don't know what I'm going to say yet. But I know it's going to be something new somehow. So like, you trust me on this and I will dig around and something I promise you will come up. And that's what happened.
And the thing that's come out in many of the discussions about your book and in reading your book and what you talk about is this idea of there being kind of two Germanys, divided Absolutely. By the Elbe and divided a little bit by faith and divided by Prussia versus the rest of Germany. Could you just explain to us the central argument of your book?
I think the central argument is probably best summed up in maps, which I use a lot in the book and which anyone listening can easily look up online, in fact, for themselves. Because if you look at a map of the German part of Charlemagne's empire at his death in 814, it's almost identical to West Germany before 1989. And not just I, but many other and more weighty commentators have said, you know, actually, that can't be just a coincidence. It's also almost exactly the same shape as the Western Germany that Napoleon created. And I think what we've completely underestimated in our view of German history is just what a complete disjuncture the so-called unification was. That's got so profoundly into our and the Germans' heads, in fact, that no one really questioned it in 1990 that the unification should happen, that Berlin should be the natural capital, and that, you know, the rich West should subsidize the poor East. But in fact, these are things that have been going on for hundreds of years, unnoticed, really.
Well, James, I wanted to ask you about that, because there is this sense of the sort of the seen and unseen history, and I don't want to preempt anything you might be saying at the Quality of Life conference in Berlin, but in that city, of course, because of its recent past, there is very much this sense of a history that's sometimes almost literally under your feet that you Absolutely. Can walk by without noticing. But in a way, that is true of the whole country, isn't it?
It's true of the whole country. It's true in spades of Berlin, because it's so concertinaed in Berlin. And Berlin's a very strange place, because it's actually by far the newest, youngest capital in Europe. If you think about, you know, Dublin was already a Viking capital by 900 AD. Berlin in 1200 AD didn't exist, at a time when every little village in Bavaria had its, still has, its beautiful Brauhaus serving beer to pilgrims. There was nothing there at all. It was still nothing, really, until about the 17th century. But the entire history of Germany then is concentrated after Bismarck's unification of 1870. Suddenly, it's just the absolute epicentre of everything. It's the place where modernity is born. It's the place where modern politics are born. It's the place where two world wars are decided. And so the whole of European history, not only German history, is suddenly concentrated in this city, which actually no one had thought of even as the natural capital of Germany until after the Prussians beat the Austrians in 1866. So it's this extraordinary concentration into a couple of generations, really, that makes Berlin so exciting, I think.
Now, in that amalgamation brought about by Bismarck, there's the feeling that Prussia is the kind of, you know, the dominant player and not the nicest person to play with, in a way. What is it about Prussia that you feel then kind of, not infected, but impacted on all the other German states that were coming into this new Germany?
It's different from the other parts of Germany in that it was always a frontier, a sort of Wild West colonial zone. It was permanently in a state of war with its Slavic or Baltic neighbours. And my own father-in-law comes from East Prussia. The family estates are now actually in the Kaliningrad Oblast, so far east were they. And I said to him, actually, not very long ago, last year, I said, come on, don't you miss it sometimes? All those East Prussian estates. And he said, miss it? 30 degrees of cold in the winter and the Russians 20 miles down the road. You miss it? You're kidding. It was always the sense of their being surrounded by potential enemies. It bred a society which, in some ways, is a bit like the kind of Ulster Scots thing that's so important in America. And I think for British thinkers, if you can conceive of a parallel world where somehow in all the wars and mess of the 17th century, the Calvinist Scots and Ulstermen somehow took over the whole country and then used it for their own purposes. That's what actually happened to Germany. The unification was actually an outright conquest. We all seem to forget, the Germans themselves seem to have forgotten. It's almost like a suppressed national trauma that Prussia actually beat all the other German countries in battle. And that even after the Austrians were beaten, the Bavarians and the guys from Frankfurt kept on fighting for another 3 weeks and kept on being beaten until they were militarily occupied by Prussia. That was all just written out by Bismarck's historian. Bismarck is, in fact, the guy who invented fake news and manipulation of the media. And so for three generations, approximately, the Germans just had no other story other than this one of unification, which is why so many people bought into it again in 1990, I think.
And what about the present day? Because we mentioned in our introduction about Angela Merkel, you know, Mutti, this sort of galvanising character, someone who stands amidst all the chaos in Europe that we've seen, and Brexit and who knows what else, as this very stable figure, popular with everybody, does her ease of governance over the last few years disguise the fact that actually there are still some of these, I don't know, even quite fundamental self-identity questions that do sort of broil away beneath the surface of modern Germany?
It could well be. I mean, there's a good deal of resentment in the last 10 years in the West as to the completely incredible sums that have been shipped to the Old East in the last 20 years, in the last 25 years. I think very few people realise how great they are. It's actually 2 trillion euros has gone directly from the West to the East. Now, that's about a Greek bailout every year, year on year, for 25 years. And that's all been funded by the prosperous West and Southern German taxpayers. And so gradually, people are making these jokes like saying, OK, if they can be a Brexit, why can't there be a Sexit? Because they call them the Saxons. Everyone east of the Elbe is a Saxon these days. And particularly when people say that, OK, $2 trillion later, this part of Germany is still voting for ex-communists and neo-Nazis. Mm. Like, what was that $2 trillion all about, please? You know, it's just not, they're different. People are saying that openly.
So do you think there could have been a more interesting discussion at the time of the falling of the Berlin Wall? Because, you know, many of the people who wanted that wall to fall was, you know, obviously their ambition was unification or to come to the West. But do you think there could have been a more interesting discussion? You know, obviously here in the UK, we know that Thatcher was unsure about the unification and she felt that for all sorts of historical and cultural reasons, she wasn't keen on it. But do you think there was a moment there to say, actually, would these two countries be better as friends, but not as one?
There was a moment, and certainly it was generally the expectation at the time, again, we tend to forget that, is that no one thought that this extraordinary division, which, as you said, had been the very epicentre of the Cold War, could just be overturned overnight without massive international discussions, all the partners without NATO and the Warsaw Pact actually saying, OK, what do we want to do with this, and gradually doing it. It happened very, very quickly, and it happened largely because if it hadn't, the whole population of East Germany would have fled to the West. There were 200,000 East Germans came west in 1 month, January 1990. And basically, the West German government thought, we have to stop this at all costs. We've got to keep those guys there. In fact, that so-called Ostflucht, the flight from the East, had been happening ever since 1850, whenever it was allowed, at more or less exactly the same rates. And the simple fact is that the East Germans don't really want to live east of the Elbe if they've got half the chance, except in Berlin, which has always been this weird island in this kind of darkness, in the dark marshlands of East Elbe. It's been this haven of liberalism and of modernity, connected really to the West by various sorts of umbilical cords, but never part of its own hinterland. And so really, the countryside of East Germany was going to drain, and was draining, very quickly into West Germany. And so Kohl essentially took the step without consulting anyone. And there was never a debate about it. There was never an election about it, never a referendum about it. He just did it. And the only reason Mitterrand allowed it was he promised to give him the euro. Everyone blames the Germans for the euro. Now, it wasn't the German idea at all. They never wanted it. It was Mitterrand's plan.
There's so many themes here. And it's constantly about, oh, well, actually, if you look back through history, there are instructive lessons. There are things that explain how and why and where we might go next. But Europe seems gripped at the moment, certainly on this side of the channel and on the mainland as well, by a almost willful neglect of history, even quite recent history. You know, if we look at like the value of the European project itself, people seem too quick to forget what it was conceived to deliver, wherever your politics are, post-World War II. But what explains that, do you think?
Various forms of national delusion, I would say. And in particular, for us, the national delusion about Germany was always a rumbling undertone to the whole Brexit campaign. It's just a German plot. Or the Germans will give us a great deal because they're so scared of losing $1 billion of car imports. Please, you know. So I think we are, the British delusion about Germany is central to it. What we underestimate, and all those people who said, of course, they'll cut us a good deal because they want to sell Audis, they forgot that to the German political class, to Germans generally, the European project is fundamental to their sense of who they are now. They do not want to run it. They want to dissolve into it. That's what they long for. The Germans long for a strong Europe into which they can safely dissolve and forget their past.
Is that a trick of identity that's possible to pull off, though? And it's interesting to get your sense, obviously, having authored this history. Can you do that? Is it a question of
a
fluid identity in that way?
If West Germany had a very strong sense of itself as a European identity. They were very non-nationalist people, which is why they're so traumatised by the sight of all these neo-Nazis over the border, so to speak, and the joke goes around, why are the Chinese so happy they still got their wall? West Germany seemed to have done it because it made the systematic attempt to put particularly the Franco-German alliance at the absolute heart of things, and then parallel with that, really, the NATO presence. So the West German, in the sense of itself, was almost completely free of nationalism. It was very, very weird. Mm. And I think a lot of Germans long for that, that sense that, that, you know, you are who you are as part of a broader thing. You're a German, but you're part of the West. You're part of Western Europe.
That liberal softer side to West Germany is there many, many years before. You do, like many people before, you try to explain, and do explain very interestingly, the rise of the Nazi Party. And there's an amazing map where you show who votes for who in the early days for the Nazis. And it's, again, it's divided by the river, and it's along lines of faith. So if you're a Catholic or a Protestant, you can guess the likelihood of you supporting the Nazis. Is that, again, one of those things when you look at the rise of the Nazi Party that surprised you, and you could break it down into this kind of division between faith and between East and West?
Absolutely. I think, like a lot of Anglo-Saxons, for want of a better word, I was brought up with this vague but very long-standing notion that somehow Protestantism is progress and Catholicism is backward. And, you know, obviously, you know, so you've got Mussolini, you've got Franco, they were all Catholics, right? So probably the Catholics voted for Hitler. And it's completely the other way around. It's extraordinary. The maps are virtually mirror images of each other. And that, I think, is because the southern and western Germans have always felt themselves to be part of something bigger, whether you call it the Holy Roman Empire or Charlemagne's Empire or the Roman Empire itself or Catholicism. That insulates people against excessive nationalism. You know, you cannot be a Catholic and say that one race is worth more than another. It just doesn't fit. Because, you know, we're all God's children. Whatever you think of Catholic Catholicism in general, it seems to inoculate people against the most extreme forms of racism. Whereas the Prussian Lutheran tradition, which I think came from probably out of contact with the Orthodox Moscow tradition, which is a totally different idea of the relationship between religion and the state, is one where whoever's boss of the state is also boss of the church. You do what you're told. And that can fit very easily into a modern tutorial frame of thinking, which the Catholic Church doesn't fit in with very well, because you've always got split loyalties. You know, if you're a Catholic, you're loyal to the Pope, which means you cannot be 100% loyal to Hitler. Therefore, you can't be a good Nazi.
Could you explain, I found it fascinating in your book, a small thing that's always intrigued me, which is, you know, the war ends in 1945. You jump to the early 1950s and you have one of the most, you know, in West Germany, one of the most modern, progressive, liberal nations already back up and running. It joins NATO. It's friends with all its neighbours. It's talking about the new European project. Is that because all the people who were actually lending their support to the Nazi Party in the west of Germany were really not that convinced by it, and deeper in their souls were just like other liberal, middle-of-the-road Europeans? Why is it that they so easily snapped back to this other kind of Germanness? Because, you know, you look at, you know, when we have disputes today with countries, you know, you look at how something happens in Iraq 10, 15, 20 years ago, you can't even get the government up and running. Here they went through the denazification process, and somehow they were still back up and running, industry doing well, society doing well so quickly.
Well, as you say, I mean, they were suddenly freed from this great weight of Prussian stroke Nazi militarism, which had happened before, of course, after the First World War. And suddenly, the moment Prussian militarism is defeated, Weimar Berlin becomes this extraordinary haven of absolute, the high point of Western liberalism. You know, suddenly you can be openly gay, you can make films anything you want, going far beyond whatever Hollywood could do in terms of sex and violence and fright, famously, in, you know, things like those old Dracula films and The Blue Angel. They were far more advanced and liberal than anything that Hollywood was doing. And that was because the country was suddenly freed from this great burden. And in fact, you know, the guy who set up West Germany after the war, Konrad Adenauer, had tried very hard to split Prussia off from West Germany after the First World War. And sadly, we didn't back him. Or we could have had probably what we got after World War II, after World War I.
And who knows what the story of history might have been. James, I wanted to change pace quite differently. We talked about the book so much. I wanted to just ask about your work as a writer. In particular, I wanted to ask you about the process involved when you've written a number of works of fiction that are then spun off into the exciting world. You touched upon it, of film and TV, this sort of thing. What's that like as a writer? Are you quite precious about looking after your projects and ensuring that they stay true to your vision?
No.
Or is it a question of signing them over, maybe taking a big check if you're lucky, and then just and waving them goodbye?
You know, the truth is, I was a quiet, hard-working grammar school boy, and then suddenly I was allowed to go to the Soho House and sit next to people called Tara and Sienna and stuff. Like, what could I do? That's where it all went.
But is that, and are you very sanguine about those processes? It doesn't,
You wouldn't change a moment of it. You know what I mean? It took a lot of years and a lot of money out of me, but it was great fun.
I split my time now between Bath and Cardiff due to having children in various places.
Okay, well, good. And we're glad you're going to be splitting part of it also with us in Berlin.
Really looking forward to it.
Where you're going to be able to come and hear James talking about his book and giving it, I think, a kind of a primer to everyone who's attending about Germany past, present, and certainly Berlin and Germany of the future. Well, James, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Andrew, I think it's music time.
Oh, yes.
So here, just for you, Andrew, I've handpicked this myself, some sleek pop sounds from Michelle Zorner, the US singer, going under the slightly peculiar moniker of Japanese Breakfast. Definitely means something else in my head. The one-time frontwoman of Philadelphia Rockers Little Big League. This is Japanese Breakfast with Machinist. When a pumpkin fights, a kingdom of your demons, a mist so palpable. You can't have it all, her and all the pleasure.
We didn't confuse you before. That's Japanese Breakfast, aka Michelle Zorner, there with Machinist. We'll be talking art right after this.
Being a pop star seems like a dazzling, lavish lifestyle, right? But have you ever wondered how your favourite pop song was written?
I do a lot of writing in the bath with my housemates sat on the toilet taking a photo.
Or who that song was really intended for.
Writing love songs in Spanish, I could say really pathetic, sad things, and it would be a secret from the audience and also from the person that I was writing about.
Join us on The Sessions at Midori House each week, where we bring in a wealth of musical talent to perform live for us and reveal a few truths about making music and keeping your ego under control. Well, sometimes.
I'm unconsciously comparing myself like a jackass to Paul McCartney.
From electropop to indie rock and with plenty of soul to boot, tune into The Sessions at Midori House every Saturday at 8:15 London time for lessons in stardom and a soundtrack to kickstart your weekend.
This year marks 50 years since the UK decriminalised homosexuality. And to help mark the occasion, Tate Britain Gallery is currently hosting Queer British Art 1861 to 1967.
The show explores how artists found ways to express themselves during a period when assumptions about gender and sexuality were being questioned. The works on show include paintings, drawings and personal film and photography from the likes of Duncan Grant, David Hockney, John Singer Sargent and Dora Carrington.
Well, its curator is Claire Barlow, and she joins us now to discuss the show. Claire, welcome to the show. First thing, I just want to ask you about the actual title of the show. I was reading the notes about how you got to this title, and obviously the word queer, I guess, wasn't used back in the 1860s, and gay somehow or certainly doesn't cover all the images that you're showing, and the many of the people featured are, of course, women as well. So you had to find a title. You consulted with gay groups and all sorts of things and campaigners for LGBT rights. Why was it so difficult and so important to get the right title?
It was very important to me to get the title right. I mean, I think queer has some advantages that other words don't. It allows you to explore a wide range of different takes on sexuality and gender identity, some of which fall into categories that we recognise today, like gay, lesbian, trans, bisexual, others of which are, you know, very, very unique to the individuals. And it was also important that I felt we shouldn't sort of impose back on these individuals terms that they themselves wouldn't recognise. Now, the word queer first starts being used in the sort of 1880s. It later, of course, gets reclaimed as a sort of very much a sort of politicised word. But it was kind of the only word that really expressed this full spectrum of different possibilities. And, you know, when we talked to people about it, they thought that this was very exciting. They were really excited that Tate was willing to sort of, you know, back this word and to sort of explore it in the exhibition.
And tell us a bit about that. We obviously know from the title we're looking at this sort of century-odd stretch from the 1860s to the 1960s, an extraordinary period of change when it comes to representations of these sort of themes. Tell us a bit about the journey that we all go on in the exhibition, because it's from, what, the Pre-Raphaelites through the Bloomsbury Group and so on. Tell us a bit about the big eras on show.
Well, the exhibition starts in 1861 because that's the end of the death penalty for sodomy in Britain. And, you know, you start off in this beautiful, lush world. One of the sort of first objects that greets you when you walk in the door is Frederick Leighton's The Sluggard, which is this really beautiful sculpture of a nude man stretching, and works by Simeon Solomon with these sort of wonderful sort of gilt frames and rich colours. You then walk through past sort of Oscar Wilde's prison door, through into sort of the world of sort of Bloomsbury. And the show goes all of the way up to sort of the 1960s with works by Francis Bacon and David Hockney. And it was quite important to me that we should end on, you know, artists who are really pushing the boundaries rather than sort of foregrounding in that final space the act that changes the law in 67, because it is only the partial decriminalisation of homosexuality. And we all know that there's a long road from there to now, and a road which we're still on.
And at the beginning of the exhibition, you look at how it was possible for many artists to pick up on, for example, male beauty, or to discuss the kind of classical view of love between men or women. But as long as they weren't seen to be participants in it themselves, they had to kind of make sure there was the distance. And then you could do images which wouldn't actually provoke any comment, really. Tell us a little bit about that early take on beauty and the hint of eroticism that's there.
Well, what's so fascinating to me about the early period of the show is that there isn't the same sense at that time that sexuality, you know, your choice of partner, your take on your gender identity, that these reflect core facets of the self. There's much more of a sense of sort of fluidity around these issues. So, you know, there's lots of works which sort of explore kind of homoerotic themes, which obviously some of their audience recognise, but not all of their audience. So there's lots of things that sort of slip under the radar. An artist like Simeon Solomon is exhibiting at the Royal Academy, but it's only when he is caught having sex with a man in a public toilet that all of these rumours that have been swirling around his work, all of these accusations of sort of unmanliness and degeneracy, which some people have been talking about in relation to his work, that these crystallise into, and this connects to this particular sexual act.
Can I just ask you about your work curating a show like this? And I wonder about the sort of inception period, the planning period, because it strikes me that just in the last, 18 months or 2 years, Britain, to a degree, feels in some ways like a less tolerant place even than it was then. Politically, there's so much more aggressive rhetoric, and people seem to be genuinely more irritated by one another and less tolerant of people's differences. Did it sort of present itself as you were curating that this was an opportunity to, I don't know, almost counter that? In a sense, is this a good time to be doing a show that has these sorts of themes and asks these kind of questions?
I think the thing that really brought it home to me was the shooting in Orlando. But up until that point, this had been, you know, my baby, my project, something which was very dear to my heart and, you know, obviously connected to my own identity. But it was kind of that moment where I suddenly realised how important it was and how important it is for the community to be seen to be sort of standing together, and that exploring this history and looking at our history across time suddenly felt like it had this sort of connection to, you know, our community across space and across all of the sort of diverse identities that are represented in our community today. I think before Orlando, it felt like there was very much a sense that, you know, we had lots of sort of disparate identities and, you know, the community still felt quite fragmented in some ways. But that moment of the sort of vigils when everyone was standing together, that felt like a really important moment.
I guess for, you know, many gay people, you look in the mirror and you wonder if you're alone, especially when you're younger. Here is a show which kind of says, look, these people, you know, our community has been present across all this huge period of time. Maybe not able to enjoy many of the legal benefits you have now. And again, is there a kind of a reassurance and a kind of a confidence in saying, look, it was not ever thus, but there were certainly part of this world that has always existed.
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up in the 1980s, and there was very much a sense that people would quite regularly say, oh, well, this whole gay thing, it's all very recent, and if everybody would just shut up about it, it will all go away again. And for me, it was only really when I got to sort of university that I realised we had this rich history and that, you know, this was a complete misrepresentation. And growing up in that environment made it much harder for me to come out. And I think that one of the sort of big messages that the show encapsulates is the sense that you are not alone. Whatever questions you are asking about your identity, whatever questions you're asking about your sexuality or your gender identity, someone has trod that path before you. They may not always have the same answers as you, but they'll have been asking the same questions. There's people in the 19th century who have incredibly gender-fluid identities. One of my favourites is the wonderful Michael Field, who was born as two people, Catherine Bradley and Edith Cooper. But they develop this shared identity as Michael Field, and their friends refer to them as the Michael Fields. Sometimes one of them is Michael, one of them is Field. Sometimes they're Catherine and Edith. It's what feels like a very fresh and very modern identity, and they're living at the same time as Oscar Wilde. Stories like that were so exciting, and they so encapsulated for me how extraordinarily diverse the past is.
On the curation of the show, there's a sentence in the notes which I thought was one of the most telling things of all. It says that there was this is a history of dustbins and bonfires, because many of the works, once people were caught up in a scandal, once it was known who they were, or when tastes changed, you know, works were got rid of. Did you think that there were actually an enormous amount of gaps as you looked around for work and representation, even though you did find many amazing pieces?
I mean, some of the huge heroes of this story, as well as, of course, the campaigners, have been the collectors. There's been so many stories that people have told me of doing things like running around a house while a friend is dying, sweeping things into bin liners to get them out before the family arrive to re-heterosexualise the life. Extraordinary tales of survival. People finding things in junk shops and squirreling them away to keep them safe. I mean, it's kind of extraordinary now to think how necessary that was, but it's been really humbling hearing those perspectives. And, you know, this exhibition, as we've, you know, been very clear in the interpretation, is the start of a conversation. We're really hoping that it will encourage more material to come out, more stories to be told, more things to be found. So yes, it's very exciting.
And I always ask this of curators, and I always feel a bit guilty because I know that the whole exhibition is like their children. You can't make people choose their favourite. Nevertheless, you gave us a little walk through the gallery earlier. I mean, is there a certain place where you stop and contemplate for that little moment longer, or something that just, seems to encapsulate everything you were trying to achieve? Is there a favourite? Can I ask the dreaded question?
It's very hard to play favourites. I think I would possibly pick two.
That's allowed. One
would be Strang's portrait of Vita Sackville West, Lady in a Red Hat. And it's a really beautiful portrait. But we know that she attended sittings for it with her then lover, Violet Trefusis. And I think if you know that, when you stand in front of a portrait, you start picturing the artist's studio, you start picturing, you know, Violet waiting for Vita to go off into the world. And that's a really sort of romantic story for me. Another object which I really love for completely different reasons is an anonymous photograph album, which is one of these things that was saved by one of my collectors. And at first, when looking through it, I said, you know, what are you showing me? Because it looked like just, you know, lots of men at military parades. But as you keep turning the pages, you realise that it's perhaps not love of country that is quite animating this collection. You know, the album gets more explicit as it goes on. We don't know who created it. All we know is they had a great love of servicemen and of jodhpurs.
what's not
who doesn't admire about that? And the show's on for some months, isn't it? It's on until...
Yes, it's on until the 1st of October.
Well, Claire, thank you for coming in to see us. The show is called Queer British Art. It's 1861 to 1967, and it's at Tate Britain here in London. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Are you an entrepreneur, architect, city maker, shop owner, media player, property developer, or chef? Then you need a ticket to the most important conference on delivering quality of life in our cities. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference is back, and this year is touching down in Berlin. Join us from the 29th of June to the 1st of July for great debate, informative panels, engaging hospitality, and a chance to see the best of Berlin. Let's make better places to live. Join us. Be inspired. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference 2017. Head to conference.monocle.com to book your ticket.
Danish filmmaker Kasper Astrup Schroeder has turned his lens to everything from the eccentric and prolific Japanese inventor Dr. Nakamats to the urban sport of free running in the past.
His latest film, Big Time, turns the camera towards both city-minded smarts and a figure capable of seemingly limitless creativity, Kasper's fellow Dane, the architect Bjarke Ingels. The founder of Bjarke Ingels Group, known as Big, he has created iconic buildings such as 2 World Trade Center in New York, the Danish Maritime Museum, and sites for tech giants such as Google. And Kasper joins us on the line now. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. First of all, you know, as a fellow Dane, you know, Bjarke is famous now around the world. How do you approach somebody when you know that he's become a bit of a national hero, somebody everybody's rather proud of? Did you feel that you could go in and be critical, or did you feel that you were dealing here with something that was a bit more complicated about the very nature of Danishness and Danish design?
I actually met him when I did the film about parkour, which is 7 years ago, and I had been friends with other architects that knew him. So my relationship was not through this project alone, and we started to just talk about film and creativity in general. And then slowly, when he started to talk about wanting to move to New York, I was intrigued and wanted to see if there was some kind of adventure there that was worth following. So the relationship developed very slowly, and he knew my films, and he was pretty confident with me just as a filmmaker. And I think that helped for me to get underneath the famous person that he has become.
And what did you want to get out of the film? You know, this is a profile of a, as we said, a very prolific architect who is really, you know, riding a crest of popularity, almost like a rock star as he goes around the world. Were you trying to show a more human side to him? Were you trying to unpick his creativity? What was it that you hoped to get from the film?
Yeah, well, I've been watching and trying to make architectural films for a long time. And to me, describing architecture just with moving images is kind of boring. I wanted to explore architecture through the people that made it or use it. And so I've always wanted to tell a kind of personal story with the film, both that was intriguing for architects, but also people that weren't interested in architecture. So it had always been an idea and a project that I wanted to combine these two. And so when I got to know him and his creativity, I was very intrigued. But I also wanted to find out if there were things in his life that were at stake, if he had a project that wasn't about architecture or his company. And so I was kind of following both storylines. And then at some point when he got that hit in the head, it kind of merged together, and there were some things he had to reevaluate in both lives that I could use as a narrative, dramatic thing in the film.
Well, and talking about the challenges of delivering that narrative, this film tells a story, it's what, gathered over, I think, 7 years, is that right in saying? And his life, as you've already suggested there, changed professionally and personally so much in that period. Sometimes if you're working on a project that has that kind of sweep and that kind of huge time frame, did you ever feel as the filmmaker that it almost gets kind of out of control? Or did you always feel very, I don't know, able to retain a very, very sharp focus?
Oh, no, it was super difficult to make. and especially because it was going so well for the company. As a filmmaker, you want to have some drama and some kind of resistance. But he would call me up and says, like, now we're doing this Google headquarters, or we're doing the Smithsonian, or... And I was like, yeah, well, that's good, but well, what's not going so well in your life? And I really wanted to get underneath all the fame and glory, and I didn't want to make a commercial. Of course, there's something intriguing about the way he works and his creativity and the architecture, but I also wanted to, like, tell more, maybe like universal story about the modern man that thrives for so much professionally but has to give up something personally. So it was not at all easy. And the reason, I mean, I didn't plan to make it over these 7 years. It just had to develop, and I had to kind of like slowly find out what it was that I wanted to tell in the film.
Well, there are a few tensions in the film. As you say, that he suffers a concussion, which gives him headaches if he works for more than an hour, and then they discover a medical condition too. There's a question about his personal life where he says, honestly, you know, I thought by now I'd have a kid and a partner, and he hasn't. We won't spoil the end. There's a bit of romance that creeps in. But I thought that probably the biggest tension, and if he likes this film and he's given it his backing, he must recognise it's as a fundamental thing. The biggest risk seems to be him just spreading himself so thinly at times. You know, he's running between projects where it's evident that he's kind of losing control of the process at times. He's got his name attached to projects where he's not really having the input that he wants to have. And he's exactly. Even making a film with you. Did you see that as an observer watching this man? And he has negotiated most of those hurdles, let's be clear. But there is a feeling that there's maybe a bit too much going on in his life.
Yeah, exactly. He's kind of put himself in a position that he knows what works and what sells. Like, he's the lead singer in a rock band that everyone wants to get the autograph from. There is an organization behind him, but basically he's put himself in a position, and that I think is a big part of the success, where he is that face, that the rock star that everyone wants to see. And then at some point it's just too much. He can't be everywhere. When he moves from Denmark, everyone in Denmark misses him, and it goes bad in Denmark. And so there are definitely some challenges that he goes through when going that big and that global. That was a big problem for a long time.
And Kasper, let me just ask you, you mentioned, it was interesting to me that you said about making films about architecture, which is so fundamental to, you know, the lives of people who live in cities and everywhere in the world, really. Do you feel that you've kind of pulled off the trick? Does this, I don't know, does it capture the essence of what it is to build, to design, to make? Or do you think, I don't know, there's more narrative still to be told in that space for you?
There's definitely so much to tell, because I made a decision that I simply couldn't include all the uses of the buildings. It had to be a very personal building about Bjarke and his story. So there is definitely also a story about the architecture. If it actually works as he intended, there was just simply not a room or time to explore that strand of his story. But to me, I wanted to make a more personal, universal, appealing story about a man and ambitions, like a more wider universal kind of story. He could have been, I guess, a lot of different professions he could have had, but I think for me it was also about a guy that wants to change the world and really make it the best he thinks it should be, but forgets himself in that story, and also look at how architecture is actually influencing our lives. Like, he talks about light and all rooftops should be used. And so all these details about what he thinks makes good architecture is definitely also something that tells a story about modern architecture, I think.
There's lots of great things in the film. I love the way that you see him. You often sit him down at various moments in the film with just a giant marker pen and a huge pad of paper for him to sketch out his ideas and explain what he's been thinking. There's this motif of the brain scan coming, which you're not quite sure what it is. It's a really, really beautiful film. And he comes across very well. Can you explain, though, the strange thing is that he also, potentially in Denmark more than anywhere else, he does kind of annoy people a little bit. Yeah, and he comes across as just a really lovable man, actually, in your film. What is it about him that, you know, when you speak to other architects, they're like, yeah, is he a bit too much show and not enough thought? And I don't know why he provokes that, because he really does come across in the film as a very well-considered, ambitious, good person.
Yeah, I agree. And it's been something that has been, I've been wondering about that as well. We, in Denmark, we have something called the Jante Law. And it's basically a fundamental thing that everyone learns, that you shouldn't think you're special. You shouldn't like stick out and like just think you can do whatever. especially in architecture with all the big egos, you don't want to stick too much out because then everyone else will hate you. And one of the reasons why he moved to New York and tried to do different adventures was because he was experiencing this. He also very early on said he wanted to make cartoons. He didn't want to be an architect. When you say something like that, it's you're already you already have the wrong stamp on you, because people still like some still refer to him as the cartoon architect that doesn't really know how to build buildings. But then he's also a guy that doesn't really care about aesthetics. His buildings, they don't really look alike. He cares about the potentials of doing something radical change to that project or like doing something no one has ever thought of. So he's, at least from what I have heard, he's not really, like, he doesn't go much into detailing and like materials. He does that, but his reputation says he doesn't. He's just this cartoon character that comes up with these crazy ideas and goes against what's expected of the project.
And maybe that's why he's so successful. What about you, Casper? Could I hear some kids squawking in the background?
Was that a cat?
It's actually my cat.
I'm at home. Right,
it's really annoying.
It has a very human quality to its cries. What's next for you, Casper? Because obviously people know your work. You do all sorts of things, short format, long form, docs, all kinds of things. What have you got up your sleeve?
I'm actually about to release a film I made in China that is about an orphanage for children whose parents are in long-term prison or on death row. It's a really heavy subject and a very different film from the somewhat lighthearted Big Time. And that's coming out here in Denmark next week. Then it'll go, hopefully, international.
Indeed. Well, we'll look forward to seeing it. Hopefully it heads this way and all around the world. Casper, thanks so much for talking to us. Great to have your company. Thanks for being on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Edition 410, Andrew, has gone the same way as the 409 that preceded it.
Out into the ether.
Into the ether. Great show. We had quite a lot of cultural nourishment. We even talked about sandwiches, which I was happy about.
Yeah, James Hoare's book is super good. It's snappy, it's thorough, but it's got all these amazing charts and maps and things. You really kind of want to dive through it. It's really, really great.
And I think he would make the perfect sort of guide if you're strolling around Germany, certainly if you're in Berlin. And probably as well to advise our listeners that there remain a few tickets available if they want to see him speak and get a primer on Germany from him at the Monocle Quality of Life conference next month.
Yeah, so it's an amazing 3 days in the German capital. We're going to be bringing together people from hospitality, from architecture, from design, all sorts of walks of life to talk about, you know, making better cities, lives, nations across the whole scale. And there's quite a lot of fun that goes with it too.
Bit of dancing. You might see Andrew Tuck dancing.
Oh, definitely.
If you're there. That's worth the admission price on its own, surely. That brings us to the end of 410. Thanks to Tom Hall, our producer, and our research team of Christian Radev and Darren Graham. Our studio manager was Claire Arban.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye.